All right, welcome, welcome everyone to Maximus Call-In Radio Show, episode 51. It's kind of amazing that we've been doing this for so long, but I enjoy taking all your questions and providing science-based answers and coaching through health questions all about health and performance optimization. I am your host, Dr. Cam Sipah. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist and clinical professor of psychiatry at UCSF Medical School, and I'm also the CEO of Maximus. This podcast is sponsored by my company. You can check us out at MaximusTribe.com. We're actually super excited to announce that we are live in 13 U.S. states as of yesterday, which covers about 41% of the U.S. population. We provide a prescription testosterone optimization service. We actually use at-home lab tests to prove that what we do works through third-party lab tests. And we use a very special and unique oral prescription medication. It's not testosterone replacement therapy, but it actually stimulates your own natural production of testosterone in a way that's safe and effective, and on average gets guys to increase their testosterone by about 1.5 to 2.5x. So check us out at MaximusTribe.com to see if you're eligible in those 13 states that we serve. Today's show is actually all about health and performance optimization. So I take live questions from the audience. All about optimizing your nutrition, your fitness, your sleep, your relationships, and anything in terms of psychological health and mindset. We always like to start the show with what I call a weekly unpopular opinion, because I like to provide contrarian, though evidence-based views on things. And if you ask most experts, health gurus out there, they talk about magnesium. What's the best form of magnesium? Almost everyone says magnesium glycinate. It's actually probably the most common form that you can get. And my unpopular opinion is that it's not the best form of magnesium. So I'm actually going to talk today about a very special form of magnesium that was just introduced to the market and why it's actually far, far superior to anything that's existed before. So first and foremost, let's talk about what magnesium is and why it's important in the first place. In fact, I was talking to a young lady recently who has a lot of stress and anxiety, and I suggested to her actually to take magnesium. And she was like, well, why? What does it do and why is it important for me? And I thought that was a great question, and I'll share the answer with you all as well. Magnesium is essentially an essential mineral or micronutrient that we naturally get in all kinds of foods. Unfortunately, our soil has become so deprived of natural foundational factors that the food, especially like the produce that we consume, is not as magnesium rich or dense as it used to be. And so although people should ideally be getting, let's say, 600 to 800 milligrams of magnesium, and I always think it's best to get your nutrients from whole foods. That's always the first principle. Unfortunately, because our food is essentially nutritionally starved compared to the old days, almost everyone is magnesium deficient. And so a lot of folks essentially will benefit from taking a magnesium supplement. Now, magnesium basically plays a role in over 300 biochemical processes in the body. It's particularly important for psychological health, because it helps dampen the stress response and is also critical for the functioning of your HPA axis, which is responsible for, and your HPG axis, which is responsible for your hormone production. And so it helps other things like vitamin D work well, essentially in your body. And so it's also one of the rare supplements that when people take it, they really describe noticing a difference in terms of how they feel. If you take most vitamins, supplements, etc., you actually, like, most of the time, no idea whether it's actually working. But I've actually done qualitative reviews and asking a lot of people, surveying a lot of people, looking at questionnaires in terms of what supplements do you actually feel like, actually thinks it's made a positive, beneficial impact in your life. And I would say magnesium is always in the top five. And the things that I think it's particularly helpful for is, number one, I think it's particularly helpful for sleep. Almost everyone has sleep problems these days in terms of falling or staying asleep. And magnesium just helps people calm down, reduce sort of anxious thoughts. It's particularly helpful for those who are on the anxiety or depression spectrums, just improves sleep latency, sleep quality quite a bit. So it's a great kind of pre bedtime pre-sleep supplement. The second thing I think it's particularly helpful for is attenuating stress and anxiety. Obviously, a lot of us live very high stress lives. We have very active work lives, a lot going on with our family, and it's just hard to juggle and manage. And it's very helpful for sort of dampening sort of the stress response and making sure that it's not too high and not too out of control. So that's the other thing that magnesium is particularly helpful for. Interestingly, in women, it may be particularly helpful for dealing with symptoms of sort of PMS, such as cramping, or if you're an athlete and you notice yourself cramping, it can be very helpful to alleviate muscle cramps along with other electrolytes such as potassium, sodium, and calcium. We don't tend to be very obviously short in sodium. We have very sodium-rich diets these days. People aren't often calcium deficient as long as they're eating, you know, a meat-based or animal-based diet. But we do particularly tend to be starved of magnesium and potassium. We don't necessarily or generally recommend taking potassium supplements, because if you overdo potassium supplements, they can cause heart issues. That's why most supplements, potassium supplements that you see on the market, don't have more than 100 milligrams. I think it's actually required by law at a time. Magnesium supplements, on the other hand, they're very hard to overdo. There is one very commonly known side effect, which is it has a laxative effect. So if you go to any sort of supermarket, vitamin store, etc., you'll typically see, you can buy magnesium off the shelf. It's a very common over-the-counter supplement. Unfortunately, though, if you go to like a CVS and Walgreens, they tend to use the very cheap forms of magnesium. So the cheapest form would be magnesium oxide. If you ever see magnesium oxide on the label of a vitamin, do not take that. It's very cheap. It's not very bioavailable at all. And you're just wasting your money because you're flushing, you know, vitamins down the toilet. Another common form is magnesium citrate. Magnesium citrate does have better bioavailability. However, the problem is it has a very strong laxative effect. So ironically, people, in fact, take it on purpose in order to reduce constipation. So if you're trying to take it, obviously, at higher dosages, just be very aware of the laxative effect. And so, and it also varies by individual. Some people are fine, and some people, they're just sitting on the toilet all day. So just don't overdo it. If you're going to try taking it, start with a low dosage, make sure that your GI system can handle it, and then work your way up. The much more commonly recommended form is a form called magnesium glycinate, also known as magnesium bisglycinate. And the reason, by the way, for all these different forms, if you're curious, like, why do we have so many forms of magnesium? The reason is most of the time, these minerals are essentially chelated, or they're chemically combined with another agent that helps it sort of move around the body, if you will. Glycine is a very common amino acid. It's one of the 20 general amino acids that our body needs, and it helps sort of the absorption of magnesium. Now, here's the interesting thing. There was a study that was published, and I'm getting now to the meat of the matter, that I wanted to share with you. There's two studies, in fact. There was a study that was published, and I'm pulling up the paper right here, December 2017, and it's called The Timeline or Bioavailability of Magnesium Compounds in Hours, Which Magnesium Compound Works Best? And it was a really great study because it basically took all the different, not every single one, but most of the common forms of magnesium, and tested them in rats and looked at their absorption in terms of, you know, how bioavailable are they in terms of their effects. So the interesting thing is, I think they looked at different forms: magnesium oxide, citrate, malate, sulfate, and a new form of magnesium that I'm here to talk about, which is magnesium acetyl taurate. Now, if you've been a loyal listener of my show, I've talked about how my favorite form of magnesium has been magnesium taurate. You can check us out. If you go on YouTube and search for magnesium taurate, you can hear my episode about that. And the reason for that is because magnesium taurate is combined with taurine, and taurine is an amino acid. You may have heard about it because they put it in Red Bull. Taurus, obviously, is the bull if you follow your zodiac signs. And taurine has its own anxiety-reducing effects. And so you get this great double whammy or double punch of magnesium and taurine, which are both very helpful, recommended, and you kind of kill two birds with one stone by taking the combined forms of them. Magnesium acetyl taurine is an acetylated form of taurine that essentially helps the magnesium cross the blood-brain barrier in a better way. So for instance, if you're familiar with NAC or N-acetylcysteine, another common dietary supplement, it's a similar acetylated form. So you take L-cysteine, the common amino acid, you acetylate it and it becomes N-acetylcysteine, and it does a much better job of crossing the blood-brain barrier, which is why NAC is a very popular antioxidant supplement, very helpful for OCD and other anxiety disorders. And it was actually a whole controversy about it being pulled on the market because it was marketed as a hangover cure, and the FDA wasn't very happy with that. Now, coming back to magnesium acetyltorate, this is a new form. It's just became available on the market. In fact, I only know one manufacturer that has it available. It's called Doublewood Supplements. You can actually buy it on Amazon. It is much more expensive than the other forms of magnesium. Magnesium is generally a dirt cheap supplement. You can buy a bottle that has 120, maybe 240 capsules, which will last you 3 to 6 months, generally speaking, for somewhere around $15 to $20. Very high bang for your buck supplement. Magnesium acetyltorate, however, this form that I mentioned that's sold by Doublewood, it comes in 60 capsules, which if you're taking two a day is only 30 servings. So you only get a month's worth for, I believe it's $15. So it's basically twice, maybe three times as expensive as most other forms of magnesium. The other thing is that it's very low in what's called elemental magnesium. Now I realize this is kind of confusing, but you have to read the label carefully because as I mentioned, there's all these different forms of magnesium. But how much of it contains actual magnesium as opposed to the glycine, taurine, or whatever it's bonded to. Now, in this particular supplement, it has 700 milligrams of the supplement, but only 45.5 milligrams of that is actual elemental magnesium, right? Now, if you look at very common brands like Dr. Best and they're using magnesium glycinate, you typically take two capsules and it'll give you 200 milligrams of elemental magnesium. And so this form, you're actually getting like a quarter of the dosage of elemental magnesium, which I thought, man, that's going to be totally worthless because you're going to have to take like six capsules of this form just to get as much as like two capsules of the other form because it's just sort of not as potent, if you will, in terms of how much elemental magnesium it has. However, the interesting thing is that it's much more bioavailable, and so you don't have to take as much of it. This first study that I mentioned compared all these different forms, and here's some interesting things that it found. First of all, it was the most bioavailable form. So in terms of looking at the uptake of the magnesium in terms of blood levels or plasma levels, as they call it, magnesium taurate was, along with magnesium malate, the highest forms. But then when they specifically looked at brain tissue, so they unfortunately killed these rats and looked at their brain tissue to see how much magnesium was basically soaked up by these rats' brains. Magnesium acetyltaurine basically outperformed every other form of magnesium by far in terms of its effects. And here's the interesting thing. They also basically had these rats do these little lab tests in terms of seeing if they're anxious or not. You can do almost these little maze studies and see their look at their behavior to see if they're acting anxious, just as you if you have a dog or cat, you can kind of tell when your dog or cat is stressed. The interesting thing is that the other forms of magnesium, such as magnesium sulfate, etc., did not affect anxiety. Magnesium acetyltorate was the only one that behaviorally reduced anxiety, which if you're taking anxiety, like I said, for psychological benefits in terms of reducing stress or anxiety, this form of it is probably the best form of it on the market. There's a couple forms that have been hyped in terms of like increasing blood-brain barrier. I've talked about magnesium taurate. This is the acetylated form. There's another one called magnesium L-threonate. You might have heard Dr. Andrew Huberman talk about that. The unfortunate thing is that's a patented form of magnesium. There's not a lot of research on it. It may be effective at crossing the blood-brain barrier, but it's never used in these head-to-head studies. And so it's very hard to say, is a magnesium taurate or magnesium acetyltorate better than magnesium L-threonate? I don't know because no one's ever looked at that because I think it's because of this patented form. And so as a result of that, I can't really answer that question, but I can look at this particular form in terms of how it performs, and it performs exceedingly well. There's a second study that was done as a follow-up to this study that was published in October 2018 called Dose-Dependent Absorption Profiles of Different Magnesium Compounds. And again, they looked at the bioavailability of magnesium. And this study I really love because it was very brilliantly done. They actually looked at three different dosages of all the magnesiums to see, well, how much of this do you actually need to get the effect that you want? They gave people 45 milligrams, 135 milligrams, or 405 milligrams of elemental magnesium. Remember, not the total form, but the actual elemental form. And that way you can do a really head-to-head comparison. And then they compared different forms, magnesium malate, magnesium acetyltorate, magnesium glycinate, magnesium citrate, and then a control group in order to compare it to that. Here's the interesting thing. When they looked at this study, they found that the common forms that people take, magnesium citrate, there's a common powder-based version of this called Calm. You'll see it even at Costco stores. That's magnesium citrate. And then magnesium malate, which comes from the malic acid that makes green apples sour. They really needed that highest dose in order to be effective. You needed to take 405 milligrams of that in order to have optimal absorption into the brain, which is possible. But the problem, as I mentioned with magnesium citrate, is if you're going to take 400 milligrams of that, it's almost certainly going to have a laxative effect and you're going to be sitting on the toilet. So not a very recommended form. Here's the interesting thing that the scientists did, though, as part of the study. They actually tried dividing the dose, which is clever, right? They're saying, well, if 400 milligrams gives you a laxative effect, why don't you take 200 milligrams divided into two dosages? And the thing is, while that does work in terms of spreading out the total amount, it doesn't work in terms of giving that maximal brain uptake, meaning that if you're trying to get that calm, zen-like feeling, splitting up the dose is not as effective as taking the whole dose together, the 400 milligrams together, which is, I think, what most people want to achieve if they're taking it for psychological reasons. So basically, there's no way of kind of hacking your way around the laxative effect. The other form, magnesium glycinate, did have really good brain absorption at only the 405 milligram dosages of it. So the thing is, I do actually think magnesium glycinate, the common form, is useful. But if you're going to take it, it's really only helpful in, based on this study for reducing sort of stress and anxiety and achieving maximal brain levels of it at that 405 milligram dosages of it. If you buy most forms of it on Amazon or your favorite supplement manufacturer, you will typically need to take at least two or four capsules of it to achieve that 400 milligram dose. And like I said, you have to just make sure that with you, your body and your chemistry, that doesn't cause too much of a laxative effect. The good news is with glycinate, it has much less of a laxative effect than the citrate. That's why it's kind of a lot more popular essentially these days. But some people are still sensitive, and so you have to see what works for you. Now here's the fascinating thing, and now I'm getting to the good part. They tested magnesium acetyltorate, this new sexy form that I'm talking about, and they found something really interesting. It doesn't matter if you took 45 milligrams, 135 milligrams, or 405 milligrams. It all worked equally the same, unlike all the other forms that you had to take the highest dose. So here's the fascinating thing. Even 45 milligrams of elemental magnesium acetyltorate worked just as much in terms of brain uptake as 405 milligrams of magnesium glycinate. So it's basically 10 times more potent on an elemental magnesium level, milligram for milligram, as the common form that everyone recommends. And so less is more, even though, like I said, it's more expensive, you don't need to take as much of it. So the form that I mentioned, Doublewood Supplements, it only has 45.5 milligrams, but that's exactly the dose that was used in the study, and it's exactly the amount that shows that was able to get brain magnesium levels up to 8 milligrams per gram protein. So the good news is you can take a tenth of the dose, essentially, of elemental magnesium, and it works just as well. So it's now essentially my new favorite form, at least for psychological reasons. If you're taking it to reduce your stress, anxiety, or sleep, I do actually recommend magnesium acetyltorin. It's actually what I take personally now. Unfortunately, the reason I actually ran across and found this new form is because the manufacturer Cal that was making my powdered magnesium taurate supplement stopped making it. And so I was like, oh man, I got to go find a new form. The reason I like the powder form is because in order to get enough magnesium, which was 325 milligrams of that old form of magnesium taurate, you have to take like a 5 gram scoop. And instead of taking 4 or 6 capsules, I would just take the powder, mix it into water. It was raspberry flavored and it's very pleasant sort of pre-bed drink. And that's an easy way of getting enough. But yeah, you had to consume basically 5 grams just to get 325 milligrams of elemental magnesium, With this new form, I only have to take 700 milligrams, so it's basically a fifth of the dose that I was taking, in order to get the 45 milligrams this study showed was effective for getting optimal brain levels. So that's my suggestion. That's my weekly unpopular opinion. The best form of magnesium is not magnesium glycinate, not magnesium L-threonate, as most people or other health gurus say. It's actually magnesium acetyl taurate, MAT. The brand name of it is Toromag. And a lot of people just don't know about it. So if you ask other people, they're probably just not in the know yet, because this research has come out only in the last couple of years, and it's only become available on the market quite recently. But I'm very excited about it. I think it'll, given the amount of magnesium deficiency that is very common amongst adult Americans, it's going to be very helpful. And if you are looking to increase your testosterone, magnesium does not increase testosterone on its own. But if you are deficient in magnesium, it may interfere with your body's own natural production. So if you supplement and get your magnesium out of sort of the depleted range and into the normal range, it may allow your body to produce, you know, what its your genetic potential will be. If you obviously want it to go above and beyond sort of average levels, that's when you can sign up for MaximusTribe.com. We actually set up a special link for Clubhouse listeners. It's MaximusTribe.com/Clubhouse, which will give you priority access to our program. All right, so that's my little bit about magnesium. Why don't we actually talk about questions? So if you have any questions from the audience, I will take them. I think there's some questions from YouTube. Victor, do you want to read some of these?
Hey, Dr. Kim. I'm actually planning to enroll in the Maximus protocol. My testosterone has been tested between 200 to 350 over the last 3 years. I've had doctors prescribe TRT, and I've been on and off of that for 3 years. I'm worried I won't get good results with just 6.25 milligrams of enclomiphene, and wondered if I enrolled, even though the doctors have given me TRT in the past. I also take 5 milligrams generic tadalafil, which I really like, though wondering if your doctors prescribe that.
Yeah, great question. So this question is from someone who's had their testosterone levels tested before, which, by the way, if you're listening to this, highly recommend all men essentially get their testosterone levels checked. Unfortunately, lab testing is just not commonly done as part of routine care in the U.S. Unfortunately, we have a sick care system, not a health care system. I always tell the story of how I had to like tell my doctor to give me a basic blood sugar test, even though my dad has type 2 diabetes and I have the genetic predisposition towards it. And he's just like, oh, you're a young, healthy male. You don't need them checked. You know, but I, you know, convinced him to do so. And it's really important because I want to obviously prevent going down the same path in terms of developing diabetes. So I always recommend, if you heard my previous podcasts, talk to your doctor about getting an annual physical exam. And as part of that, get a lab test done so you can get your testosterone levels checked as well. This caller has had their levels checked and found that their levels are between 200 and 350 over the last 3 years. Those are actually quite low levels. In fact, depending on what the reference range of that particular lab is that you were tested on, that's often sort of in the what's called hypogonadal range, which means it's sort of like low testosterone. That's why it sounds like that's you've had your doctors prescribe TRT or testosterone replacement therapy on and off for the last 3 years. I'm actually curious, given that you've tried TRT, been on and off of it, why hasn't it worked for you? Or have you run into you know, side effects or issues that you want to try something different? Or is it just because, you know, you don't want the testicular shrinkage and infertility issues that are associated with taking TRT? So the question is, I'm worried I wouldn't get good results on our protocol. We typically prescribe 6.25 milligrams of enclomiphene, which stimulates your own natural production. Here's the thing. It just depends. Everyone's different. And this is the beauty of our program. It's a personalized program. So we tend to put people on low, slow, conservative dosages because some people actually do quite well on 6.25. And we obviously don't want to overdo it. I'd rather underdo it and then work our way up. So the good thing about what we do is we put you on a conservative dose. The doctor will, if it's indicated for you, the doctor makes that decision. And then you retest after 30 days. After 30 days, if you're not feeling optimal or your lab results are not responding as optimally as you'd like, we can always adjust or titrate the dosage up or down. And so that's the best thing I can say is essentially try it out. see how it does in terms of your lab results and obviously how you feel. We treat symptoms, not numbers. It's more important how you feel in the end than what the number on the lab test ultimately says. And we can always adjust your dosages from there. So that's what I would say. But we have lots of folks who are ex-CRT users who don't want to be dependent on TRT. They want to stimulate their own natural production. Again, the analogy that I always make is like, you know, it's essentially like, you know, if you haven't been driving your car for a while, your car battery will die. That's essentially like what's being on TRT is like. And so you need to replace your car battery, at least jumpstart it, which is essentially what enclamiphene in our protocol does. It restarts or kickstarts your system and your testes in particular into producing more of its own testosterone. So try it out, see how it does. But like I said, there's lots of folks who are ex-CRT users who are come on our protocol and they're able to find good benefits. You just may need a different dosage than other people because of your past history. The other part two of your question was about taking 5 milligrams of generic tadalafil. So for folks who are listening and they're wondering what that is, you may have commonly heard of the brand name of it. That's Cialis. Cialis is in the same category of ED medications like Viagra, which almost everyone has heard of. They're both PDE5 inhibitors. They block a particular enzyme that increases vasodilation or blood flow to your blood vessels, which obviously improves people's ability to have an erection. We are not currently prescribing that at Maximus, but keep on the lookout. We actually are releasing a sexual health and performance product that will have that and some other goodies in the future. So what I would suggest is just go on the current King protocol. If you're interested and the doctor decides it's right for you, get your testosterone into the optimal range. A lot of people find that just by increasing their testosterone, in fact, 75% of people, when they go on these types of medications, which are called SERM, selective estrogen receptor modulators, they find that their libido improves. So a lot of people misunderstand, essentially, Viagra and Cialis do not increase libido. All they do is make you hard, which is great. It's great to have a nice erection, but it doesn't stimulate desire, sexual desire or libido. That is much better done by testosterone, which is the master male hormone. I actually think they're very complementary if you think about them. Testosterone increases libido. Tadalafil or Cialis increases your ability to have erections. So they're synergistic, but they do different things essentially in the body. Tadalafil does not increase testosterone. All it does is increase blood flow. So I always say it increases sexual performance, right? Performance meaning like the erection, but it doesn't enhance the enjoyment of sex. And that is a lot more has to do with, I think, testosterone and dopamine, to be honest. All right. So Ian has a question. If I take more than 45 milligrams of elemental magnesium through magnesium acetyltorate, does it have better effects? Great question. No, it doesn't. That's the interesting thing about the study. More is not better. They compared three different dosages, as I mentioned, 45 milligrams, 135 milligrams, and 405 milligrams. And there was no statistically significant difference between those different forms, even though the latter form was 10 times as much. So the good thing for your pocketbook and not having to swallow more than two pills is more is not better. It's just very potent and effective. And so all you need is 45 milligrams. In fact, I wish the study tested a lower form, like half the dose, 22 and a half milligrams, because I'm curious if just taking one pill would be enough. And that would obviously be the most cost effective. You can obviously just subjectively try that for yourself and see if it works. But I always believe in following the research and the science. It showed that 45 milligrams works, and it's not that expensive to $15 for a month supply. So I would stick to 45 milligrams, and you can always experiment from there. It sounds like we had a follow-up question from the first caller. The reason I was on and off is because I didn't like the testicular shrinkage, and I don't like doing injections. Well, I don't blame you. I absolutely would not do TRT if I don't have to do it either, because I don't like, even though I'm in the healthcare field and I get lab tested. So, you know, I get injections in terms of getting a blood draw from a phlebotomist, and it's not fun to have someone stick a needle in your veins. Now, obviously, testosterone can be injected intramuscularly, which is like, you know, a stab literally in your butt, or and sometimes can be done subcutaneously, meaning just underneath the skin if you're using sort of insulin needles. But in the end, like, you're injecting yourself, and, you know, injecting yourself is not very fun, right? You know, if you ever work with folks who have type 1 diabetes and they have to inject insulin, which is another hormone like testosterone, believe me, they would prefer not to do it if they didn't absolutely need it and their pancreas didn't produce was able to produce its own insulin. So I don't blame you. There are new forms of testosterone these days, like creams and gels, but they have their own problems, which is you can't rub it on your wife or your children. It'll masculinize them, and you got to be really careful about washing it off or waiting a certain amount of hours before you have sex. It's not a great user experience. That's why I started Maximus, was because, if there was an oral medication, just like a normal pill that could double your testosterone levels, it would be a blockbuster. And there is, and it's called enclamiphene, and we prescribe it. So I don't blame you. So try it out and see how it does. The other question that you brought up is, so I had trouble complying and also having to donate blood to reduce hematocrit and reduce blood cells, which is too many variables. That's actually a really great point. I'm glad you brought it up. A lot of people, when they take testosterone, synthetic testosterone from outside of their body, even though they call it bioidentical testosterone, meaning that it's similar to the kind that your body produced, I think that's such a faux pas, by the way. It's still synthetic, even though it's biologically similar to your body. It doesn't act the same way because it shuts down your own production. And so the first difference is you're not getting all the beneficial neurohormones or brain hormones that comes in the cascade of steroidogenesis, meaning your body starts with cholesterol that you consume from food like eggs and shrimp, and it turns that into pregnenolone, progesterone, all the way down to testosterone and estradiol. And when you shut down your own production from taking TRT, you're missing out on those beneficial brain hormones. That's why really good HRT doctors will make sure that you're supplementing with things like pregnenolone to make up for it. But as you point out, now there's a lot of variables to juggle. One of the side effects that you mentioned is also that it can mess with hematocrit levels. So it increases red blood cells. Your blood essentially becomes too thick, which is a little bit dangerous. And so you have to constantly monitor your labs, make sure that it's not too high. And if they are, they actually recommend people donate blood on a regular basis who are on TRT to alleviate essentially the side effect. The nice thing about enclamiphene in our protocol is it doesn't significantly increase hematocrit in most people. And so it doesn't require that same level of monitoring and concern as TRT. That's why I essentially say it's a lot safer, especially for young, healthy men. But thank you, sir, very much for sharing your experience with TRT. And it really highlights essentially why we've developed a TRT alternative. Because as Dr. Jim Hotling, our medical advisor, said, and you should check out his podcast if you look us up on YouTube, Maximus Podcast is a really great episode. He's a professor of urology at the University of Utah. His point of view is basically, if you're under the age of 50, you should not be on TRT, right? Unless you have a missing testicle or a testicular injury and you can't produce your own testosterone, that doesn't obviously apply to most people. You should really consider this sort of testosterone stimulation or maximization, as we call it, to stimulate your own natural production. So thank you for those really great questions from YouTube. If you have any more questions, feel free to type them in. Now I'm going to return to Clubhouse. If you have any questions on Clubhouse, please raise your hand and I can take any questions from you live. Or if you're listening on Twitter Spaces, I see Shane, Dave, Abhijit, Dan, John, Robin, please chime in and I can answer any questions. I see a YouTube question. I was looking to join Maximus's King Protocol, but I'm located in Canada. Any plans to expand to Canada, even though you guys just reached 13 states? Congrats, by the way. Thank you for the congrats. Unfortunately, no immediate plans to be in Canada. I'd love to get there one day, but different countries have totally different laws when it comes to medicines and telemedicine. And so even though we employ people in Canada to do our engineering, we cannot prescribe there right now. So unfortunately not, but if you come south of the border, happy to help serve you. All right, other questions? Otherwise, we can go back and answer some questions that were submitted from last week. Could you send those over to me, Victor? I just got a request from... Hey, Dan, I think you can talk now.
Dr. Kemp, what do you think about dairy foods? Are they good or bad for testosterone?
That's a really interesting question. I haven't specifically seen the literature on dairy and testosterone in particular, but I'll talk about sort of theoretical mechanisms and also just the general health benefits of dairy, which may answer your question. In general, I actually think dairy is a health food. It gets very much maligned these days. There's a very strong anti-dairy stance, And I think it's almost like promoted by, as I like to call it, deep soy, which is like the big food industry of like the Oatlys and nut milks of the world, which make everyone convinced that milk is terrible for you. So I think it's absolutely silly because every single person who's listening to me right now basically survived the first year of their life consuming breast milk, or at least a breast milk substitute formula, which is essential, obviously, to infantile growth. So we're mammals by definition because we consume milk. Now, do adults need to consume milk? No, of course not. Babies wean off milk and can start to consume solid food. And really, if you think about it, milk is almost like a growth formula, right? It's a very interesting formula if you look at their macronutrients, by the way, because it's almost an equal amount, if you're talking about whole milk, of carbs, fat, and protein, right? And in nature, you don't typically see the combination of fat and carbs together. There's very rare amounts of foods. The two most common ones that I typically cite are milk and nuts. And if you think about them, both of them essentially fatten animal mammals up. Obviously, we try to fatten babies up so they can grow up and survive. But also, like nuts are, hoarded by squirrels in the wintertime because they're going and hibernating and they want to kind of fatten up for the winter. Typically, you want to avoid taking sort of too much carbs and fats together in the same meal. And so that's just one thing I'd be cognizant about with dairy. Is if you are overweight or obese and you're trying to lose weight, consuming a lot of milk in particular, in terms of the carbs come from lactose or the milk sugar, with the full fat is a little fattening. So even though I like whole milk because the fat soluble vitamins are in the fatty component or the cream of the milk, so like vitamins A, D, K, and E are typically in that portion of it. If you're trying to lose weight, skim milk actually may be better because you're going to cut your calories a lot more. So that's the first thing I would say. The other alternative, obviously, is to not consume milk, which is high and very high in lactose. But there are now these ultra-filtered milks, which I'm a fan of. There's a brand called Fairlife that ultra-filters their milk, and so you can get like 30 grams of protein. Most milk has like 12 to 13 grams in a normal cup. And this has, 2.5, 3 times as much with only 3 grams of sugar. So they essentially filter it in a way that it's much higher in protein, much lower in sugar. And so it almost like makes dairy healthier, if you will. Even though I'm generally not a fan of processing foods, this is a rare example of what I call a nutrifood, meaning that it's processed for health, not just for cost and taste. And so I actually do recommend, I actually do like Fairlife. And then the third kind of dairy that I like in particular is fermented dairy. So dairy that's been made into yogurt. The best types of yogurt, in my opinion, are Greek yogurt, Icelandic skyr, and other yogurt that's essentially strained, right? So when they talk about strained yogurt, they're straining out the whey component, the whey fraction of it, in which a lot of actually the sugar lies. And so Greek yogurt is essentially a form of like old school processing before Fairlife had their crazy filters. People would just strain it manually using cheesecloths and strain out the sugar and make it thicker, obviously, to consume in yogurt form. It's higher in protein, lower in sugar. There's an interesting body of research literature, however, that shows that, first of all, consumption of milk is associated with less type 2 diabetes. So even though, as I mentioned, excess sugar can be fattening, dairy in particular, maybe it's because of the other components of dairy, doesn't seem to exacerbate diabetes. It's one of these interesting like exceptions to the rule. So dairy in general, at least when it comes to diabetes, tends to be good for you. And in particular, fermented dairy, the yogurt has even better associations. Now these are associational studies, so take it with a big grain of salt. Has even lower incidences of type 2 diabetes. So even though there's not a lot of literature on sort of dairy and testosterone, at least we know that dairy and type 2 diabetes, particularly fermented dairies like yogurt. The other one I didn't mention is kefir. I'm a big fan of kefir as well. Kefir is not necessarily lower in sugar, but it has 14 probiotics as opposed to yogurt, which typically only has 4 probiotic strains. And so it's very healthy for the gut, essentially. As long as you don't mind the sour taste, I actually like sour foods, but kefir is an excellent choice for dairy consumption as well. Benefits of dairy is it's a really great source of calcium. As I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, we were talking about the four micronutrients, elemental micronutrients in terms of potassium, magnesium, calcium, and sodium. Dairy is an excellent source of calcium. The other thing that dairy is a very helpful source of is cholesterol, right? So we talked about how cholesterol is essentially the foundation for your body to make steroids like testosterone, and particularly full fat dairy, butter in particular, especially if it's grass fed and so it's like very nutrient dense, are good sources of cholesterol and good sources of those fat soluble vitamins that we talked about, A, D, E, and K. I actually really like to say, and then this is actually on our website, if you check out the science page of MaximusTribe.com, we shouldn't call vitamin D a vitamin at all. It's really hormone D. These vitamins, the fat soluble ones in particular, actually act as hormones in the body. There's numerous papers that actually substantiate this. And so if you have a vitamin D deficiency, what it should actually be called is hormone D deficiency, HDD. And it has a lot of negative health effects. And so if you're consuming full fat dairy, you're making sure in the form of milk, cream, yogurt, butter, you're making sure you're getting that vitamin D, that vitamin A, that vitamin K, which is a really essential cofactor. You always want to take vitamin K along with your vitamin D because it enhances the absorption and makes sure that that calcium that I talked about is going into the right place. When you take a high dose vitamin D supplement, it increases the amount of calcium, but you don't want that calcium going to your arteries and obviously clogging them up. You want it going to your bones where it'll mineralize your bones and strengthen your bones, right? Because people always associate drinking milk with healthy, strong bones. That's what we've kind of been taught by all the Got Milk commercials. That's true if and only if you're taking it with vitamin K. So if you're consuming full fat milk, it'll naturally have that vitamin K2 in it, particularly in a form called MK4, which is the animal-based form of it. The plant-based form of it is called vitamin K, but all of it essentially converts into MK4 in your body. And so if you're taking it as a supplement, you always want to make sure that you're taking vitamin D along with vitamin K2 together. So I am a fan of dairy, as I mentioned. It reduces the incidence, at least associationally, of type 2 diabetes. It makes sure that you're getting enough calcium, enough fat-soluble vitamins, and cholesterol, all of which should, in theory, provide the substrates or the foundations for your body to make its own optimal testosterone. So even though there's no studies that directly say consuming dairy or yogurt is going to increase your testosterone, it will reduce the likelihood that you have these vitamins or these hormonal vitamin deficiencies, which may be impairing your testosterone production. So great question, Dan. All right, I'm bringing up Cowboy Theta as a speaker. Did you want to ask a question?
Yeah, hello. Doctor, what is the impact of exercise on testosterone?
Yeah, great question. So the question is, what is the impact of exercise on testosterone? So there's two things that are important to note. There's the acute and then there's the long-term effects. So acute exercise, particularly strength training, weightlifting, or high-intensity exercise, has a stimulatory effect on testosterone, meaning that it'll increase testosterone, it'll increase growth hormone. So there's lots of studies when they show that if a guy particularly goes to the gym, does a hard workout, especially one that's sort of like muscle strengthening, weightlifting, it will acutely increase your testosterone growth hormone. Part of probably the reason why we feel so good when we go and we work out at the gym. So it has this sort of temporary effect. Obviously, a couple hours after, testosterone growth hormone levels go back down to normal. So if you think about it, every time you work out, you almost get this like temporary boost in terms of your testosterone and growth hormone, which is not necessarily long lasting, but if you do it on a regular basis, like you're working out at least, let's say, 3 to 5 times a week, which is the general recommendation that I provide in terms of strength training, it will, you know, elevate your levels more than someone who is sedentary. So those acute levels can turn into basically long-term benefits if you're doing it consistently enough, even though it is going up and down. You know, 5 little boosts or 5 spikes essentially a week are better than someone who's having no spikes because they're sitting on their butt all day being sedentary. And so I actually do think it's absolutely critical for optimal testosterone production that you do regular muscle strengthening exercise. So That's part one of that question. The thing you want to be aware of, however, is excessive cardiovascular exercise. So I mentioned, for instance, high intensity HIIT training. You may have heard of high intensity interval training. That's great to do. I generally recommend that people, though, don't do it more than 1 to 2 times a week. If you're talking about true HIIT training, what I mean by true HIIT training is a Tabata style workout in which you're sprinting all out for 20 seconds, followed by 10 seconds of rest. You're repeating that 8 times for a total of 4 minutes. And it may not sound like a lot to only work out for 4 minutes, but these guys are going full bore. If you actually read the original studies that Tabata did in Japan, he was doing it with the Japanese Olympic speed skating team. And these guys, Olympic athletes, were like on the ground huffing and puffing, right? So this is true high intensity interval training. It's great. It's very, very efficient exercise, and it's great at increasing VO2 max and endurance capacity, but it strains the body. It particularly strains the central nervous system. And so you don't want to do it more than 1 to 2 times a week. Now, general cardio, if you're talking about sort of medium intensity cardio, we're talking about jogging, cycling at a normal pace, that you can do 3 to 5 times a week, no problem. And that's generally the type of cardio that most people do. They're just going on a run. They're not sprinting, you know, until they're almost passing out, like I'm talking about here. That is helpful and beneficial, but I would just say be wary of like the mileage that you're putting in. If you're a regular runner, right? If you're talking about, let's say, this is an approximation, you're doing like 10 to 20 miles a week, you're probably fine in terms of testosterone levels. If you start amping up the mileage and you start being essentially an endurance athlete, now you're running 30 to 50 miles a week, which is what I used to run when I was a competitive runner, in fact, doing track and cross country, it actually may start to have a negative or deleterious impact on your testosterone levels. Now, everyone is going to vary in terms of this because of your body's ability to recover. Your age makes a big difference. I was very young when I was running competitively, so it may have been totally fine. If you're starting to do that in your 40s and 50s and you're putting in a ton of mileage, your ability to recover essentially decreases with age. And so you may run into overtraining a lot more than you did when you're younger. So my philosophy is, look, cardio is good for you. I'd recommend everyone do cardio for cardiovascular health. But it's not absolutely necessary. If you're doing like 3 to 5 times of strength training a week, and you're doing, let's say, a lot of low intensity steady state exercise, meaning walking, you should be walking at least 7,500 steps a day. That amount of walking plus that amount of strength training, you don't really need to do too much cardio. Like I said, once a week, if at most. I like to joke that sexual activity is the best kind of cardio that there is. So if you have a healthy relationship with your significant other, have as much cardio as you'd like. That's probably the best form. But just watch excessive endurance training, because that may actually have a negative impact if you overdo it. So especially if you're talking about half marathon to marathon running, I'm not a fan of. I actually discourage men in particular from doing that, women as well. There's interesting research that like looks at people who complete marathons, and they have not only higher incidences of upper respiratory infections, meaning they get higher rates of colds and flu, because it suppresses their immune system to run a marathon, but they also actually have elevated cardiac markers, which are only generally seen in people who have heart attacks. It basically like damages the cardiac or heart muscle and makes it look like you're having a heart attack, which obviously, you know, even if you're not a scientist, it's like that doesn't probably sound very healthy. I don't think human beings are meant to run 26 miles in a row, which is why the first guy who did it at marathon literally passed away and died. So I think honestly it's an ego trip that most people run marathons, and it's for bragging rights, and there's no point of doing it. So as a former reformed distance runner, and I can say that because I took the red pill, so to speak, it's better to run fast than it is to run long. So that's the only caveat I would say with exercise. Most exercise is beneficial for testosterone. Just don't overdo it in terms of the cardio. All right, got another request. Shane. Looks like he's connecting. I can give it a minute. Hey, Shane.
Hey, Dr. Cameron. Sorry about that. My internet is a bit fuzzy. I was just wondering one thing. As you know, recently I've been practicing the dopamine fasting.
Yes.
It's not my first time doing it, and I find completely indispensable for tackling procrastination and for tackling, procrastination and for focusing on my studies, because I'm in medical school, so it's obviously huge study demand, exams all the time, so you just need to be constantly focused, and I find it indispensable for tackling that, and I must thank you for that program, because it's the only thing that's helped me focus on antibodies that help me tackle procrastination and everything. I was just wondering, how do you see dopamine fasting in terms of, you know, a structured program? Because I find that whenever I stop my dopamine fast, I readopt all my old bad habits immediately. And, you know, I really have to go back. I really have to go back into, you know, dopamine fasting again to get the same level of concentration, the same focus, the same dedication. Do you see dopamine fasting as something that kind of needs to be kind of done chronically, you know, throughout life, or it's something you should do in, you know, certain for a few weeks or a few months at a time? How do you see it in terms of long-term adherence? Do you see it as something, you know, that should be done kind of semi-permanently, or something that's more kind of a reset to get into good habits?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And thank you for your review, by the way. So just for the folks who are listening, Shane actually posted on Twitter. I believe you came back to Twitter after 2 months of being gone and doing dopamine fasting, and talked about all the beneficial effects that you experienced, especially, as you said, being a medical student and having to, you know, really focus and study to a high degree of concentration. So first and foremost, I'm really glad that, you know, you found benefit from it in your own personal life. So here's the way that I would describe it. If you think about it, we live in an addictive world, right? And it's actually designed to be addictive. Companies like Netflix literally have PowerPoint presentations in which they talk about their competition is sleep, right? They're like, there's only so many waking hours and we want to keep you awake. And that's why they autoplay new videos after you're done watching an episode, to encourage binge watching. So if you think about these things, they're literally digital dopamine dealers. They're digital drug dealers. And there's no difference between a processed food company that makes Cheetos, which are like chemically designed so that you don't notice how many calories you're consuming, and, you know, Netflix, which is, you know, competing for your attention. They're all essentially a form of addiction from a psychological perspective as a psychologist. It doesn't matter if it's a drug, a drink, a food, or a digital addiction. Addictions take many essentially different forms. The bad news is we're in a hyper addictive environment, and also a lot of us, especially like in American society, are lacking sort of the primary satisfactions, as Francis Weller talks about, in terms of family and community and purpose and meaning. And so when people lack these things, they naturally turn to addictions, or what are called these secondary satisfactions, in order to quell the deep meaninglessness and loneliness that is pervasive in our lives. And so when you're in that context in which basically people are predisposed to addictive behavior, and then you get all these big tech companies, big food companies, which collectively we call sort of deep soy, competing for your attention, then how do we fight against that, right? Because temptation is always going to be there, grabbing and vying for your attention, if not proactively doing so, because it's constantly sending you notifications, or you're constantly feeling FOMO, fear of missing out, if you're not on the latest and greatest, you know, app. Or, you know, I have a lot of friends actually who are active Twitter users, and when they stop using it, they feel like they're missing out on the conversation, or kind of almost being on the online town square if they're not actively participating. So for all of these reasons, that's why I think dopamine fasting is really important. And just to clarify for everyone listening, dopamine fasting does not mean trying to eliminate or avoid dopamine. Dopamine is necessary. Obviously, you have conditions in which low dopamine, such as ADHD and Parkinson's, are very problematic. Dopamine fasting is really referring to cutting down on addictive behaviors, which are mediated by dopamine. Remember that dopamine is not the pleasure neurotransmitter. It's actually the anticipation of reward. In fact, it may be opioids, the opiate receptors and the endogenous opiates that are more associated with reward, or with pleasure, I should say. While dopamine is really the more the anticipation of reward. So when we see that notification or that new email on our phone, we get that dopamine hit even before we click it, because we know that there's like a prize awaiting for us. And in order to avoid sort of that stimulus response conditioning that we're so addicted to, dopamine fasting is basically saying, look, I'm not going to, just like intermittent fasting, I'm not going to eat 24/7. We weren't designed to just sit there and graze all day. It also means I'm not going to pick up my phone 200 times a day, 100 to 200 times a day, which is the average amount of people, times that people pick up their phone. and they're constantly essentially pulling the slot machine, seeking a reward. Now, the problem is, as Shane kind of points out, it's hard to be completely abstinent, right? So like Shane wasn't on Twitter for 2 months, but now he's back. And hopefully, you know, this is worth it in terms of the educational content that I'm providing. But there's a difference between someone who says, all right, I'm going to use Twitter between 6 and 7 p.m. because that's when Dr. Cam's show is on. I hopefully will get a lot of like informational density, right? Just like nutritional density of like, you know, good quality foods. You want high informational density as well, where hopefully this is an hour where you've learned a lot. And then you can take that hour and then you can go back offline to your normal life and engage with your friends and family and do real shit. So that's an example of dopamine fasting where you're saying, I'm going to use it for an hour a day. I'm going to use it for an hour a week, whatever it is that's right for you. I'm not prescribing an amount of time, but I generally find that less than 30 to 60 minutes of social media a day is probably best for most people, unless you obviously need to use it professionally for work. That's a different matter. But for most people, in terms of recreational use of social media, you really want to keep it to less than 30 to 60 minutes. And you want to do that in a scheduled time. That's what I call dopamine feasting, meaning you should set aside a time a priori beforehand and say, this is the time that I'm going to check my messages. This is the time I'm going to respond to my DMs. This is the time I'm going to catch up with the social feed and see what's interesting out there in the Web3 crypto world, if you're following all that. Catch up on my articles, do whatever it is that I need to do. But I'm going to do it between the hours of, let's say, as I mentioned, 6 and 7 o'clock. The benefit of doing that is that you're doing it according to a time, not an impulse, right? The way that most people use social media is they do it according to an impulse, meaning they do it when they're lonely, angry, anxious, tired, bored, etc. And so it quells that negative feeling and obviously provides a positive feeling of interesting stimulation, what I call double reinforcement, because that takes the bad feeling away and also introduces a good feeling. And that's the basis for addiction. So as opposed to being triggered by our internal stimuli in terms of negative emotions, dopamine fasting says, nope, the only thing that's going to trigger your use is a schedule, right? I do it at 6 o'clock, I end it at 7 o'clock, and then I fast, meaning I go back and do it. And I generally tell people the best time to fast is 1 to up to 4 hours before bed. You don't want to be using your phone, your laptop, bright lights, television right before bed, especially if you have trouble sleeping. That is likely contributing not just because of the blue light, but because of the overstimulation of your brain. So especially at least that last hour before you go to bed, you want to unwind. You want to do relaxing things. You want to take a shower. You want to spend quality time with your loved one. You want to read a book. Interestingly, reading is not very addictive. I've never had a client who's been like a book addict, but definitely people who are social media addicts, because it's just not reinforcing the same way. So that's basically dopamine fasting. But Shane, to finally answer your question, given that we can't escape technology, we're not Luddites, and I don't, you know, advocate neo-Ludditism in terms of we cannot be completely abstinent. You can choose to be abstinent from alcohol, even though that's hard socially. You can absolutely be abstinent from drugs. There's no reason to take any recreational drugs. But it's very hard to be abstinent from technology or the internet, right? Especially if you have like a professional white-collar job. And so as a result of that, and also probably social and family pressure, most people will choose to not be abstinent from technology and social media. So the question is, how do I use it responsibly, as they like to say in alcohol, or use it minimally in a way that's not as, problematic. And so essentially, if you think about it, dopamine fasting is moderation, right? It's just scheduled moderation. That's purposeful and intentful. And so, yes, I actually do think it's something that you need to do for the rest of your life because it prevents overdoing addictive things. Now, I don't think you need to do super long, prolonged fast necessarily for the rest of your life. I think it's great that you did like a 2-month fast where you basically did not go on Twitter or social media. But I think for most people, it's practical to just say, look, I'm limiting it to 30 minutes a day. I gave the example of like the Chinese. They actually have written this into law. So kids under the age of 18, I believe, aren't you allowed to use like computer or video games for, I believe, more than I think it's like an hour a day and 3 hours a day on weekends. And they can't use it between the hours of 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. So you can't use it overnight when you should be sleeping. I believe they've even made it more restrictive. So it's probably even less than that now. So basically, they're only limited to a few hours a week. That's a great example of dopamine fasting. It's saying, well, you don't need to like never play video games, but you need to limit it severely during the week. Obviously, when you're working or going to school, You can use a little bit more on the weekends, but still having limits there as well. And it obviously shouldn't interfere with your sleep. I think that more like daily to weekly model is much more practical for most people to practice on a regular basis, literally for the rest of their lives, rather than like, oh, I need to abstain and go on a 5-week Vipassana retreat, have no stimulation. That's not what dopamine fasting is about. It's not asceticism or the rejection of technology or the rejection of pleasure. I'm sure during those 2 months, you studied a lot, had fun, hung out with people in real life. So it's not anti-pleasure. It's just anti-addiction. So that's my point of view on it. Thank you so much for your testimonial. I think it got a lot of people interested. And if you're interested in following up on it, you should read my specific protocol. There's unfortunately a ton of misinformation out there on the media, which is exactly why we need dopamine fasting, is because journalists write clickbait trash like in the New York Times, which the journalist I think actually later apologized for. But check out the original protocol. If you just Google my name, Dr. Cameron Sapaw, and Medium or LinkedIn, it's hosted on both Medium and LinkedIn. And if you join our Discord at discord.maximustribe.com, we actually have a channel called Weekly Radio Show. I will actually post the links for everything I talked about today in the notes. I'll put the link in for the dopamine fasting article, the magnesium acetyltorate, which we started out talking about. If you want a link to purchase that, you can do that. I don't get any benefit from doing that other than an Amazon affiliate link. We can also continue the conversation there. If you didn't have any time to answer a question during this hour, I can always answer it, on our community. So that's it for today. We actually ran a couple of minutes over 7 o'clock. Thank you everyone for the great questions. Thank you everyone who joined us on Twitter Spaces. Thanks everyone who joined us on Clubhouse, Discord, and Instagram Live and YouTube Live. Thank you for the great questions. We had a lot of questions coming in from YouTube as well. So if you're just interested in joining our community, as I mentioned, join us at discord.maximustribe.com. If you're interested in our protocol, check us out at maximustribe.com/clubhouse. Thank you, everyone, for a really great radio show. We're on every single Thursday at 6 o'clock Pacific time. I'll catch you then. And otherwise, you can check me out on social media. You can find my username. It's Dr. Cam Maximus. Pleasure to talk to you all, and have a happy and healthy rest of your Thursday.